You're listening to Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Here with a fresh perspective on the market, the economy, and your money. From the Spokane office of the Opus 111 Group, Mike Mayle.
Good morning. Welcome to Money Management. I'm Mike Mayle with the Opus 111 Group, and we are here every Saturday to talk with you about the markets, the economy, and to give you what we hope are good insights into how to react to and deal with the marketplace. We certainly had a series of interesting sessions this past week, what with all the various and sundry economic and Fed news. And what I want to do after we go over the weekly data is to talk about some of the Fed moves, talk about the jobs report, which came out yesterday, and perhaps, at least in my opinion, how you can work with or through these changing markets. Some attitude adjusting, if you will. So the Dow closed yesterday at another new record high. It was up 134 points at 38,654. And the S&P also at another new record high. It ended at 49.58. NASDAQ up at 15,628. The Russell 2000 small cap index off just a bit on the close Friday. It was at 1,965. 10-year Treasury had a fun day. It was as low as 3.86% at the open. It ended at 4.02, which is, for a bond, is a huge move. And that was in response to some of these reports we'll be talking about here. Crude lower at $72.63 a barrel. Soft white wheat at $6.47. Gold lower on the interest rate news at $2,054 an ounce. And silver off at $22.79 an ounce. So that's where we ended the week. And on Wednesday, as you may have heard, the Fed sent a signal that it's done raising interest rates. But it made it also clear that it's not ready to start cutting right away. And that's what got the traders all verklempt. They were all for sure they were going to drop the interest rates and kind of pulled the rug out from under them. But more about that in a minute. So the Fed Open Market Committee, that's the part of the Federal Reserve Board that actually decides about interest rates, they removed language in their report that had indicated a willingness to keep raising rates until inflation had been brought under control and was, in fact, on its way toward the Fed's 2% annual inflation goal. Well, it said that there are now no plans to cut rates with inflation still running above that goal. And that statement, the Fed statement, further provided limited guidance as to that it was done hiking. Like I said, it's a little murky, only outlining factors that will go into quote-unquote adjustments to policy. What their statement said, and I'm quoting, the committee does not expect it will be appropriate to reduce the target range, and that's of interest rates, until it gained greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably toward 2%, unquote. And Mr. Powell went on to say, I don't think it's likely that the committee will reach a level of confidence by the time of the March meeting to identify March as the time to do that. And again, that's what the traders were all looking for, planning on, hoping for. And as a result of his comment, the averages hit their session lows almost immediately as the breath was out of his mouth. Mr. Powell's comments during his press conference stated that incoming data has been in line with what the Fed wants to see to start cutting the rate process, and they don't really have reason to expect the positive progression of inflation data will shift in the months ahead. So their reason for remaining in a pause mode is that they simply want to see the trend continue for a longer period in order for them to, as they say, build greater confidence that they'll hit and sustain that 2% number. Now, the Atlanta Fed, now this is a separate issue totally, they put out a report every month called the GDP Now. And this week they put out an estimate that's showing an estimate for, what was it, for this quarter, for the first quarter, of 4.2% growth. Now, that was up from the 3.3% that we printed in the fourth quarter. And the Atlanta Fed had only had a 3% growth for this quarter last week. They say that their reason for the increase was driven by improved projections for both personal consumption and private investment. So what that says is that they're looking for broad continued growth in the overall economy. That's not bad news. So we've got the jobs report, the December jobs report, as it's known, came out yesterday, and they're called non-farm payrolls, and they increased by 353,000 folks in January. That was the biggest gain in a year, and well above any forecast from any group on Bloomberg. And the highest number from those folks had been 185,000 jobs being added, and that's according to the Labor Department. Now, in addition, gains in both November and December for jobs, payrolls, were revised upward by 126,000 folks. And again, this suggests that higher interest rates have not cooled hiring as much as the tea leaf readers had previously thought. Now, let me address kind of a little more detail the Wednesday-Thursday thing. Now, on Wednesday, as I mentioned, Mr. Powell announced no change in rates at this meeting, the February meeting, or the next meeting in March. So traders in the financial media have been pushing and hoping for the rates to be dropped. They've been talking about it, crepey, I don't know, at least a month anyway, maybe more, and have been setting up their positions accordingly. Liz Young, who's head of investment strategy at SoFi, had this to say. She said, "I think what he told us today," and again, this was Wednesday, "was you haven't been listening." She goes on to say, "I think Mr. Powell has been pretty clear from the jump, from the beginning of this hiking cycle, that they would rather stay too high for a little bit too long than to cut too early. He hasn't changed his tune on that. The market continued to try to bully him into a different position. And today, Wednesday, he said, 'I will not be bullied. We call the shots,'" unquote. Well, there you are. And so even though we're getting better than expected earnings results, and we will be seeing a lot more earnings reports next week, many people were simply selling because they wanted to take the money. You know, they call it sell on the news, buy on the rumor. And so a lot of people who had maintained these positions from last year, and they say, "Oh gosh, something's changed and the world is ending, so I want to take those profits and get out of town." Well, they use this news as an excuse, and the Dow on Wednesday closed lower by 367 points just in response to this. Now, on Thursday, apparently all was forgiven. The traders adjusted to the new reality. The rate hike talk was now in the rearview mirror, and at the end of the day, remember, we dropped 367 points Wednesday? Well, the Dow added 369 points on Thursday. So now the issue becomes when the Fed actually starts to cut. So did you get caught in that whiplash? Big move days in the markets are often followed by big moves in the opposite direction within a relatively short time. These kinds of moves aren't unusual, but for many it can be quite uncomfortable, especially if you're not anticipating it. Howard Marks, who is a highly regarded portfolio manager, had this to say last November, actually. He said, and I'm quoting, "Note that volatility is often a misnomer. Strategists and the media often warn there is volatility ahead." Now, what they really mean, Mr. Marks says, is that there may be price declines ahead. No one ever worries about or minds experiencing volatility to the upside, end of quote, and amen, I would say. I have never had anyone complain to me about, "Oh, these stocks are much too volatile when they're going up." So it's just a change in numbers, that's all. Sometimes it happens more frequently than others. Now, wages also outpaced expectations. It jumped 4.5%, this is nationally, last month from the year earlier, and the unemployment rate held steady at 3.7% nationally. Now, those bond yields, as I said, they jumped up from 3.86 up to 4.07 at the close. And that's a sign that the traders are afraid. These guys are not exactly steely-eyed, you know. Afraid that the strong data would prevent the Fed from cutting interest rates as soon as they had hoped. Well, boo-hoo. The surprisingly strong jobs report did show continued strength in the economy. But again, the unknown is when will the Fed raise interest rates? And by the way, this last week, Walmart announced a 3-for-1 stock split, and it's going to be effective the end of February. So where it closed yesterday, 170. So that means at the end of February, you'll be able to buy the new shares at around, well, if the price stays the same, around $56 a share. Right now, I want to start giving you some thoughts, insights, suggestions as to how best you can perhaps mentally and emotionally deal with what is going on here. Some folks have a whole lot harder time doing that than others, and for those of you that are have a significant toughness and, you know, this is just so much academic eyewash, well, okay. But for most folks, it's not quite that simple. So hopefully I'm going to give you some good gouge and you'll be able to use it to your benefit. Now, before, you know, just to kind of put this whole thing in context, there's a economics professor from Cambridge University and over in England named Elroy Dimson. And Professor Dimson offered this. He says, risk means more things than that can happen than will happen. So there you go. Can then will. You know, risk is not guaranteed, unlike what a lot of the financial media would like you to believe. So on Tuesday, you know, it was like kind of the results were good, but not good enough. And that was the reaction to the quarterly results from both Alphabet, Google, and Microsoft. They both reported revenues and earnings that were better than estimates, but they both sold off. Welcome to trader mentality. So, these stocks were, as the traders like to say, priced for perfection. Alphabet had been up 56% through 2023. It climbed to a new high last week, and which was above its prior record from late 21. And Microsoft up 70%, 7-0, over the past 12 months. And that, too, also they also hit a recently new high. And in the weeks heading into their earnings reports, many investors were buying both of these as they expected positive surprises. Read that as the Fed saying, no, we're taking interest rates down now. Well, they were left disappointed on Wednesday along with some others. Now, a big challenge for investors isn't predicting market direction. I mean, don't waste your time. You can't do it. You know, it's learning not to get hung up on those good days or bad days or weeks because, as we just discussed, volatility cuts both ways, up and down. And so, for example, good days on Thursday often follow bad days, like on Wednesday, and they just happen. And over time, all it is, it simply becomes a part of the returns that help bring you to your long-term goals. That's it. You know, don't make any big deal out of them because I dare you to say, no, I don't dare you. I defy you to remember what the market did a week ago or that particular share you may be interested in. What did it do? What was the price range a week ago? Doesn't matter. It's not relative to anything because, as I say, you know, you don't want to get hung up on trying to figure out market direction. We think it makes a whole lot more sense for you to focus on what your goals are instead, your personal goals, because that's going to change your approach. Not perhaps tactically, but in terms of how much money is in which type of account and so on, for what kinds of needs. You have a near-term need and a longer-term need, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, think of the bumps that we endure day to day, not as a bump, something to be in the way of getting to your goals, but it's kind of like the toll you're paying to get to those goals. You know, it's part of the trade-off for the stock's higher long-term returns. Now, in a related note, there's something called the behavior gap. Now, what that is, the short version, the difference between the investment results published by any given fund versus the actual results received by the fund's individual investors. Now, there's a difference between what's called the dollar-weighted returns. Now, what that is, that's what you get if you hold an asset over a period of time based on your own pattern of investment, withdrawals, and cash flows. And so those dollar-weighted returns, you know, that you in general experience versus the time-weighted returns. Now, this is the other side. These time-weighted returns break up a return on an investment portfolio into separate intervals, which are based on whether money was added or withdrawn from the fund. And that's what gets recorded by Morningstar as the fund's quote-unquote track record. The difference between the two, between that dollar-weighted and time-rated returns, is the behavior gap. For example, a basic stock fund has a track record of having produced a 9% average annualized rate of return over the course of 10 years. That's not bad. So you can imagine the volatility it took for these returns to be produced, because it sure as heck wasn't in fixed income. For example, 1 year, it's up 23%. The next year, it's up 4%. Following year, up 12%. Year after that, down 8%. Then back up 11%, so on. Now, you don't really have to know much about either investing or human nature to understand that most of the money that came into that fund probably arrived about 23 seconds after that 23% gain was posted. A fund that has typically posted huge gains and outperformed its peers always looks like an obvious buy to most of the, inexperienced investors. You know, it's a FOMO thing. That's a fear of missing out. Jeepers, it's going up. I better get some of that stuff. And based on these data, you can probably already know which year the most money flowed out of that fund. You remember when it was up just 4%? Well, once upon a time, there was this publication called Money Magazine. Now, advisors really didn't care for it much because it was pretty much a shill for the mutual fund industry. Almost all the ads in the thing were for mutual funds. But what they did do was every probably 6 months, here's the 10 best mutual funds to buy now. And usually around that same time, they'd have the 10 worst. Now, once upon a time, over a five-year period, these good funds and bad funds were tracked to see just how did that all work out. Well, interestingly enough, and I wouldn't make any significant final determinations on this, but it works out most of the time, that those funds that they were touting as, gee, these are great, did just what we were talking about in this other example fund, where people were throwing money at them, and, it's hard to keep up because the fund managers are now trying to move a lot more money than what they had before, and it just doesn't work out right in most cases. And so you see that these guys that did so well typically underperform in the next few years. And, interesting enough, the ones that they said, hey, don't buy these, hey, they didn't do too badly. Matter of fact, they outperformed the ones that they said don't buy. My point being, in a rather windy manner, is to simply say, just because the price is down doesn't mean it's a bad investment, nor just because the price is up does it mean it's a good one. There's a lot more to it than that. You know, investors have a tendency to want to back winners and run from the losers. You know, that's natural. It's in our DNA to want to do it, and we even if we don't consciously realize it. You know, a fund that has just declined or underperformed looks like it should be tossed aside. You know, making a habit of reacting to performance this way, you're for sure going to lose. The market rewards those who can endure discomfort or do the things that others simply cannot bring themselves to do, which is one reason you have advisors and money managers to be able to take some of those day-to-day buy-sell decisions off your hands. But, you know, one of the things, you like, sit tight when things are volatile or ignore a bubble, regardless of how rich your brother-in-law says he's getting. You know, and these things can feel nearly impossible to do in certain circumstances, which is, quite frankly, why you get rewarded for doing it. You know, nothing's easy. Let me back up. Nothing in the markets is ever as simple as I was describing before the break. In other words, you know, just sit back, watch the markets and stuff like that. People can do it, trust me. But a lot of folks have a real lot of trouble doing it. And, you know, what is simple is that there's no, absolutely no evidence that winning funds or stocks remain winning funds or stocks forever. There's also no evidence that anyone can reliably select them in advance or determine the right time to sell out. See, here's the problem. If you get hinky and you feel like you got to get out of Dodge, okay, why are you getting out and when are you going to do it? Okay. Because then when that's done, why would you get back in and when would you do it? Rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. That gets to be a big pain. And it's also, that's where that behavior gap comes into play and you find you're getting not near the returns that the funds say that they're putting out. Look in the mirror. You know, there's plenty of evidence for the fact that trading on your emotions, buying high and selling low repeatedly, is definitely a losing strategy. No one would logically do this, and that's true. However, it's your emotions that cause these behaviors. Therefore, it's emotions that you need to train to control the most. How are you going to act when this happens? And then do it. You know, people are people. Whether it's the 1860s or the 2020s, if you read market history, you can see that you know, there is, as they say, nothing new under the sun. Market cycles have been pretty much the same regardless of what the heck kind of market you're talking about. And so, you know, everything about the markets can change, but people and the kinds of incentives that drive their behavior, that doesn't change. The three drivers of the market, if you will, of investors: fear, hope, and greed. I was told that after probably 3 weeks in the business 112 years ago. Those are the three things that are always floating around to cause people to do things. You know, I'm afraid it's going to go down, or I'm afraid it's not going to go much higher, or gosh knows what. But fear, hope, and greed are happening in concert with one another in almost every type of transaction that you engage in with the marketplace. And that's always been the case. Well, as long as I've been doing it, it's been the case. And that's only been since the Pleistocene era. So, changing gears yet again. I got to learn how to do this changing gears better. But anyway, that's what I'm doing. excuse me. I've been reading, watching, listening to, and if you will, enduring financial journalism for more than 5 decades. Now, based on that exposure, I feel quite confident in saying to you that the general tone of the more popular financial, quote-unquote, news media outlets is either one or the other of two commonly held views. One, when the stock market is dropping enough for most folks to get worried, financial journalism is always right there to say, yes, stocks may have gotten cheaper, which actually means that their valuations may have improved, but they can, could, might, maybe get a whole lot cheaper because of the end of the world coming, or this or that, or whatever other economic financial crisis they want to throw at you. And, of course, then don't buy. And I might add parenthetically that financial news media shows love it when the markets are underperforming because their ratings go sky high. All the less experienced investors are looking to these cats for answers. And it's a good way to guarantee, in my opinion, longer term underperformance. But that's a whole nother story. Now, on the other hand, when the market has rallied a lot, those same financial media types say, oh, stocks are overvalued and the market's too high. They certainly can't go up much further, if at all, from here. So, once again, don't buy. So there's no buying going on, is there? I don't know what's going on. No, of course. And just in case your brother-in-law is saying very authoritatively, and I'm hearing some of this from people now, the market's too high, significantly overvalued. Okay, well, ask that person. You know, not in a in-your-face way, but just curious. Ask him this. How do you define overvaluation? Now, by way of full disclosure, currently the S&P's P-E ratio, the price-to-earnings ratio, and that was at 47.70, and it closed yesterday at 49.58. So it's probably a little bit lower than this. But in any case, it is a little higher than its average. Excuse me, if you use FactSet's consensus earnings estimate for 2024 for the S&P, of $245 in earnings, that PE translates to 19.5. The Guide to Markets from J.P. Morgan Asset Management says the 30-year average PE for the S&P is 16.6. So that's not exactly out of the box at all. Now, successful long-term stock investing, first and foremost, is about compounding. You know, if you don't want to hear that, ask Mr. Buffett about compounding. And as his late partner, Charlie Munger, so memorably said, he said the first rule of compounding is to never interrupt it unnecessarily. Don't be jumping in and out for no good reason other than the news is a little strange. And by the way, if you do have someone asking you this, you know, some of the valuation type questions as a basis for bailing, ask them then, where would they put their money? Presumably while you're waiting for stocks to stop being overvalued. There'll be a lot of going on, I think. As an aside, this had nothing to do directly with investing, but I think it does longer term have an effect on what will be the Electoral College and bigger picture kinds of considerations. It's the migration between states. You know, who's going where? This is from the Census Bureau, and it's from July of 22 through July of 23. And it said, on domestic net migration, that's in and out, the net winners, they have 10. Number one is Idaho. Yay for Idaho. Okay, we know you guys. You're good people. I can see why people would want to go there. Number three is Montana. And number seven is Arizona. And number 10 is Texas. There's some other worthy states in there, but none in the neighborhood. Anyhow, on the other hand, the top 10 losers, you could probably do this off the top of your head. New York, far and away, number one. California, number three. Illinois is number four. Number eight is Massachusetts. Number nine, New Jersey. Number 10, Maryland. All of those states that where they're losing people, high tax country, let's just say high social unrest, people vote with their pocketbooks. And in that regard, here's U-Haul, and this is part of the same report. If you want to compare and contrast, if you wanted to move from, say, San Francisco to Boise, that would be a good trade. The rate for a U-Haul rental is $4,325 from San Francisco to Boise. Conversely, should you, for whatever reason, want to move from Boise to San Francisco, that same vehicle, $674. Supply and demand is alive and well, folks. So, we've got one more segment, and I'd appreciate it greatly if you would come on back. And we're going to be talking more about market situation and some thoughts some data here to give you some better ideas about the overall market situation. Now, a couple, I won't call them closing comments, but some finishing thoughts, if you will, about the markets and perhaps attitudes you might want to consider. You know, there's been recently a lot of talk about, oh, look how much money I can get in a money market now, or a CD, or one thing or another. And, you know, although cash might currently seem to be attractive because of the Fed tightening policy and relatively higher short-term interest rates, the truth is cash is a terrible asset class to hold for longer periods. When you stretch it out and look at it compared to, well, almost every other asset class, it ranks as the lowest returning asset class for every time horizon studied. The only ones that are even close are Japanese securities, and they're starting to come out of that, and commodities. So there you are. And investing in cash might be opportunistic from time to time, but particularly during periods of rising inflation, the actual unattractiveness of cash grows a bunch as you extend your time horizon. Now, every other asset class has proven superior to cash when defining risk as the probability of a loss. Now, we're talking real return. In other words, after tax and after inflation. So you might want to date cash every now and again, but you probably wouldn't want to marry it. Now, you know, today's stock markets, highly speculative across the board. Individual investors, more active participants, taking more risk than at any time since the global financial crisis. And, you know, their enthusiasm shouldn't lead them away from following their financial strategies, however. Now, here's some thoughts to kind of hopefully back that up. There's a report that we got from DFA, that's Dimension Financial Advisors. They're a fund advisor company. And they had these three market insights that I thought were pretty good. They said the long-term total return, okay, that's dividends, interest, plus growth. The long-term total return of the S&P 500 does, in fact, average 10% a year. But in only seven of the last 98 years, you got to go back to 1926 to get good data. So 1926 to 2023, in all that period of time, only seven of those years has the average annual return fallen within 2 percentage points either side of the average. In other words, between 8 and 12%. So, you know, to say, oh, I didn't get the average. Well, seven times out of 98, I don't guess you're going to get it either, because there's a lot of times it's higher. Sometimes it's lower, because yearly returns have ranged from as high as a positive 54% to as low as a minus 43%. Yeah, I'll take that 54, thank you very much. And we may ask, which of those numbers is considered as volatile? If you answered the down year, you have unfortunately demonstrated that you have a completely irrational / journalistic concept of volatility. In other words, you're just listening to what the news people are telling you. You know, once you understand that that volatility is simply a way of tracking the extent of randomness in both directions, you realize that both those numbers are volatile. Now, the third thing that DFA offered up was that in those 98 years, from 1926 through 2023, the S&P annual total return, again, dividends, interest, plus growth, has been positive 72 times, negative 26 times. So, in other words, about 3 out of 4 times they were positive in 1 year increments. And I from Bloomberg, I've got how have the rolling periods with positive returns, dividends reinvested from 26 to 2023. So every 1 year increment from that, over that period of time, you've got a 75% chance of it being positive. A 3 year increment, you've got about an 85% chance. A 5 year increment, 89%. 10 year increment, 95%. 15 year increment, 99.7%. And 20 years, 100%. So, in other words, by the time you've been invested for at least 3 years in stocks, you're historically in the green 85% of the time. Okay? 85%. And at just 5 years, and don't, you know, just as an aside, you don't want to be investing in stocks for something, I would say that 5 years is a good time horizon to be thinking how long you're going to be invested, let's put it that way. For if you need money in a lesser period of time, you have to put it into a fixed income vehicle so you know it's going to be there. I mean, you could hit it right and you don't have more money, but if you absolutely need it, this is not gambling. This is investing. Big difference. So, again, you should hold shares for at least 5 years. So 5 years, you know, you're talking 89% of the time, all they've been positive. So 7 out of 8, 7-to-1 odds against holding cash. Not a good idea. Cash also, you know, close proximity to fixed income instruments. You know, this time, time drains the risk out of mainstream stocks. In other words, the name stocks. And at the long-term advances, permanent, well, declines are temporary. Look it up. I mean, if you look at what this thing called a mountain chart, you know, up and to the right, sure, there's those valleys, but they keep going up, don't they? You know, in the, when you, is the most indirect useful belief for so-called risk-averse investor. Those folks that are call themselves that, they're not really risk-averse, they're loss-averse, because if they were really risk-averse, they wouldn't put all their money in a dang fixed income. That's an entirely different thing. So, granted, neither this nor any other statistical demonstration of a record proves anything. Because, hey, guess what? There's no facts about the future. You can't do that. Well, not yet anyway, right? And after all, these facts are most vividly driven home, not just how time has erased even the deepest declines, but how quickly. So, I don't know if I'm going to have enough time for this one. Okay. Let me just synopsize some things. Over, for people turning 62 this year, which is where the Social Security Administration says most folks retire, here's how the market has done since they showed up on the planet. That goes back to 1962, and they were born in They were born in 62, and they are 62. Just look at their draw. The S&P closed in 1962 at 63. Closed last year at 47.70. Cash dividend in 1962 for the S&P 500 was $2.15. Last year, it was $70.30. The Consumer Price Index, measuring inflation at our level, ended 1962 at 30. It closed out last year at 307. So to put it in context, the 62-year scorecard is that the S&P is up 76 times, dividends are up 33 times, and consumer price index up, quote-unquote, only 10 times. So it may, your entire lives, if you think back, high-quality stocks have been the simplest and most effortless way of building your real net of inflation worth, while also generating the dividend income you need in retirement. That's all I got to say. That's it in a nutshell. Well, we are out of time, and we'll be back next week with more information. And, of course, I must say that the war cry goes Aggs. And so thank you very much for listening, folks. I do totally appreciate it. And, again, we'll be back hopefully with some good news next week. And have a positive and productive week. My name is Mike Mayall. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and you have been listening to Money Management.
Join us again next week at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Mike Mayall, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Have a question, comment, or want to find out if you'd be a good fit with Opus 111? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investment involves risk and is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.